Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Rebecca Dillingham on the show. She runs the blog and the podcast Dissident Mama, dissidentmama.net. She's run that since 2016, correct?
Yes.
2016. So you are in your eighth year, I guess, entering into it close. 7 years entering the eighth year. According to your bio, you've achieved a BA in journalism from the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Yes.
Is that the same as Madison, Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah, the Berkeley of the Midwest.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's the same school. You describe yourself as a recovering feminist socialist atheist.
Yes.
And so I guess you've, you attribute this to growing up? Many people never grow out of that. So,
right. Yeah. Just growing up and, you know, kind of the 70s and 80s that were like an innocent time. And I was raised by, I call my parents like Reagan Republicans. You know, they were conservative by the standards, but they just, I was not prepared to go out into the world and these entry points of the onslaught of what was it called woke back then, but you know, just political correctness and
yes,
all this kind of thing. And I was just like a sponge and soaked it all up, especially when I went to Madison. So it's been a long journey.
So your parents naively sent you off to college unprepared?
Kind of. Well, like... it took me 10 years to get my, bachelor's degree. So I made a lot of mistakes along the way. They paid for college a couple of times. And then after that, they're like, no mas. So they were actually smart. But then I decided, you know, I got real serious about writing it out. And I told myself, I want to go to a very serious journalism school and I'm going to do it. But whatever. It was just a 10-year journey. And I did a lot of traveling and a lot of drugs and a lot of bad things in that decade. So, you know, and then I had to pull myself out of that dark pit.
Well, and you did, apparently. Good. Congratulations.
Yeah. Still, you know, sometimes it's hard to see the light, but yes, I'm on the right path at least now.
Yeah. None of us live in this world or have grown up in this world unscathed or undamaged. We're all damaged goods, as they say.
Yes, it's true.
The powers that be make sure of that. It's you're a Richmond native, Richmond, Virginia.
Yep, born and raised, left after 24 years. Mm-hmm.
That used to be, when someone said they're from Richmond, I used to think they're like a Southern conservative. It isn't the case anymore.
Well, no, it was a very conservative place when I grew up there. And it was always a city, you know, the capital and, the city of Richmond was never like teeny tiny. It wasn't like as big as Charlotte or Atlanta, but, you know, it was, I always called it like a really big small town or a really small city. Like you would run into people you knew, all this kind of thing. Uh-huh. But for all intents and purposes, it was, you know, conservative-ish, but there was always a real good music scene in Richmond, like GWAR, if you've ever heard of the band GWAR.
Oh, yeah.
They're from Richmond.
Lowrider
VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, was always an artsy school, very good art program, but it also had a contingent of normality as well, you know, and it was surrounded by history, but that has all changed. That's all been torn down.
Well,
and
you've
now
had all those statues, right? Monument Row and all that.
Monument Avenue, they're all gone. And even the White House of the Confederacy is morphed by the Medical College of Virginia now. Like, it's actually really hard to find because it's just all these giant medical buildings around it. So there's still some things there that haven't been torn down, but it's just different. And I don't go back often. It's pretty depressing. But most of my family lives there. So I will not go back to Monument Avenue ever because it would make me too sad. Yeah.
You don't want to check out the Arthur Ashe statue?
No, well, I grew up when they built that thing, and I used to run winter track at the Arthur Ashe Center right there on the boulevard, which is now called Arthur Ashe Boulevard. So I know all about Arthur Ashe. They don't have to give me a statue for me to know about it.
I always thought it was kind of odd looking because I saw the statue, and you have all these stately, you know, classic statues of Lee on the horse and, you know, horseback and Confederate generals. And then you have this guy holding a tennis racket.
And And the joke always was that there were little kids like grabbing his leg or looking up to him like they were fawning over him because he was so brave or whatever. And it looked like he was beating them with the tennis racket. That was always the joke.
It's like, well, yeah. And sometimes I imagine the art, the artistry on that statue isn't quite as good as the classical statues.
Right. I appreciate a good monument, even if it's not somebody I like. And that one's all right. They certainly make uglier ones now.
Oh yeah, the recent one they did for Martin Luther King up in Boston. Did you see that one?
Oh my gosh.
The Embrace or something. And
my take on that, I can't even say on your show because it's probably a family show. It looked very sexual to me. It was very odd.
Everything is now, right?
Yeah.
So that's it is very odd, and it's almost like an insult, insulting themselves. Okay, well, so you run this podcast program, Dissident Mama, and mm-hmm. I guess you cover an array of cultural topics, Southern tradition, yeah. Traditional Christianity, issues like homeschooling, and of course, current events, a good amount of historical revisionism. You interview a lot of guests. We both had mutual guests on. You interviewed Ian Michael Jones. He's often on my show. Mm-hmm. You describe yourself as a Southern nationalist. Mm-hmm. And so, what is Southern nationalism, and how does it pertain to today's crisis?
Well, it's interesting. The term nationalism to me has always been a precarious one because I think of a nation as something very defined and specific, and I also think of that would be borders, language, culture, things that. An ethnos that has produced an ethos that unfolds over hundreds of years. Okay. So, for America to have a nationalism, I'm very distrustful of that, right? I feel like we have that now and it's an empire. And, you know, nationalism to me in some forms can be equated with centralization. I'm absolutely opposed to centralization. I think smaller is better. Size and scope really matter of how you live and how much prosperity and health and happiness people have within that. So anyway, when I use the term Southern nationalism, I'm thinking small, you know, so I would define it as me being a product of a people who are Southerners and have shared a history, unfolding over 400 years from British common law heritage that has been handed down to me that I want to hand down to my progeny. Now, I will tell you, I have very mixed genealogy. I'm actually a quarter Lebanese, but the other three quarters is, a lot of English, some Scotch, some Scottish, not Scotch. I'll get in trouble if I say that. Scottish, Irish, some Welsh, but... but what was handed down to me was this British law common heritage that I was marinated in, my parents were marinated in, and was passed down to me. So I see Southern nationalism as something for the Southern people. Now, when you start talking about the Southern people, that is when we can start getting into the weeds a lot, because that's a very hard thing to define. You know, there are plenty of Southerners that were born in, let's say, my hometown of Richmond, Virginia, that love that the statues came down, that don't like anything about heritage and history, that want to forget their roots, right? And there are people from other climes, I would not call them Yankees, because Yankees, I see that as a mindset. That's just somebody who wants to meddle in your business and tell you what to do and come in and make you pay for stuff, right? You know, it's very a morally superior stance. Now, a lot of them are from above the Mason-Dixon line, but there's Yankees everywhere, right? You know, mm-hmm. just like there's rednecks everywhere, there's Yankees everywhere. So anyway, you can have somebody coming who wasn't born in the South, but can come here and adopt the ethos, whether or not they have the ethnos. And by ethnos, I don't mean strictly ethnicity either. So a lot of these terms, we could, talk about those as well. But they want to make their home here. And it's not about America being an idea either, or the South being an idea. That's not true either, because you can't build a nation. You can't build a people or a culture on ideas. America tried it. and it's a horrible failure and it's a wreck. And everybody knows that because we're all living in the hellscape that is it. But you can still have people who come in and adopt that too. So there are, you know, Patrick Cleburne, who was a big Civil War general. I mean, he was from Ireland. I mean, not like that was his ancestry. He was from Ireland, you know, and he adopted the, you know, the ethos of the South, and he loved it. And now, being that he was Western European, he was from the British, you know, that British Isle area, whatever, it was, you know, more palatable to him, but he saw it as his home more than he did Ireland. So there's a lot of things. When I say a people, you know, it's basically people who want to live together, help each other out, and live under an umbrella that is something passed down, British common law heritage. Smaller is better. Sweep your own back porch. Stop meddling with people. You know, help each other out. So this is, it's a hard prescription because, you know, the South has it more, I think, than any other part of the U.S. Maybe Vermont has it because it's such a small state and they actually have a really big secession movement up there. That's right.
The Vermont Second Republic. Yeah.
Right. So, and Texas has it, but Texas is giant, you know, I mean, so there's different parts of Texas and, you know, people from San Antonio think the people who live in the panhandle are way different in, you know, than them. So I'm a Southern nationalist because A, I know that the Yankee Empire is failing. It has been violent. And it likes to plunder and it likes to kill people. And right now I'm in its crosshairs. The Southern people are in its crosshairs because we, as in the Southern people, were the gauge that always kind of held the conservative feet to the fire of America when it started to go off track. Well, that's one of the reasons we are in its crosshairs. So I think I kind of answered your question, but I am there because they're my people. It's just like, you know, my family's my people, you know, the people mm-hmm. closest to me are going to be part of my tribe. So my, if you read The Honorable Cause, of which I wrote a chapter, you know, my definition of Southern nationalism is a little bit different than other people and we have different standards for it. But I think the overarching theme is that America's failing and smaller is better. Now, how we navigate through that, when we navigate through it, you know, a lot of people want to do it violently, not in the book I just mentioned, but some people do. But no, I think it's just going to happen by default. And we can start kind of creating these smaller parallel societies, these smaller institutions, and making, tapping back into what makes us a people now. And then when poop hits the fan, you know, hopefully we'll have a few of our ducks in a row.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about ethnos, that's linguistic, it's religion, these things, and the forms of people. And of course, Southern identity obviously was very diverse from the
always
get-go.
But it
sort of had that searing experience in the defeat of the so-called American Civil War, the war between the states, mm-hmm. where that sort of a Southern identity was forged, sort of an ethnogenesis occurred from that mm-hmm. conflict. You know, it's kind of a common experience, the notion of the lost cause, defeat, and that forms an identity, of course. And this comes to into fruition, or it's incarnated in the late part of the 19th century. This is the period of reconciliation, of course. Mm-hmm. And this is when we have the spasm of monuments being built, and this is done for a reason. It's a sort of a reassertion of Southern identity, a recognition of its unique culture, and sort of for at least a little while, the centralizers, the North, is going to kind of leave the South alone. Because that changes in the middle part of the 20th century for a lot of reasons. But I guess let you explain, you know, secession, defeat, and then reconstruction and reconciliation. This is these are very important phases in the creation of a Southern identity. And of course, then its attempt now to destroy it. The spasm of iconoclasm that we've seen in recent years. This is something in within living memory, at least my own, when I was young. It was Southerners were considered kind of cool. Music was celebrated, TV shows, the people who weren't from the South liked to support the Confederate flag because it was a sign of rebellion and independence and being different. And then all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but maybe in the course of 15, 20 years, it became equated to something as, you know, like the swastika or something, you know, because these all this is how narratives change. This is how you study history, realize what you're learning about history. It all depends on what the current political agenda is, and that and a narrative will be spun that suits that current agenda. And what we're being told, at least what we're how people are taught about these events or these occurrences, change from decade to decade. So much known that everyone thinks the Civil War is all about slavery, the same way that everyone thinks World War II is all about the Holocaust, where you go back 40 years, 50 years, and you study the historiography of these events, it's very different. And it reflects sort of the who's getting power now, who's at the top of the heap, at least a part of the national government. But I'll let you talk about it.
Yeah, so just secession in the 1860s would be, you know, America was born in secession, right? America, the colonies, seceded from Great Britain, right? This is how we were born, right? So anybody who says, you know, the Union now forever perpetual, you know, that Southerners were traitors, I mean, that's just silliness, because a state had to accede to the Constitution at the convention in Philadelphia. So anything you accede to, you can secede from. So that's just silly to say that they were traitors. And, you know, a lot of historians smarter than me, I'm not a historian, I'm just an amateur who loves history. But, you know, from the 1790s onwards, people in America were like, this isn't working. You know, we don't like you for this reason and that reason. Some were political, some were cultural. There was just all sorts of things. But I mean, the secession talk was around. I mean, when Thomas Jefferson was elected in 1801 or whatever, you know, people wanted to secede over that, you know. So secession talk was nothing new. Now, leading up to the 1860s, there also became this, you know, like this whole manifest destiny thing. And I write about this in my chapter, that Southerners were unionists because, A, they didn't think that their state could possibly, the state would be better off within this voluntary union. It made them stronger. There were better economic relations, all these kinds of things.
Yeah, it was right? a common market and mutual defense pact.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's how it was understood. Yeah. Wasn't supposed to be like an empire of liberty, as you know.
Correct. Yeah. So anyway, well, actually, Jefferson called the empires of liberty. Those were the like smaller states.
Yeah, but I mean, in the Laconian sense, you know.
Yes, yeah. The Laconian sense, not that kind of empire. Yeah. So anyway, okay, so you know, people are pulling together. They're trying their best to get over their differences. But I mean, if you look at history from the 1800s up until, you know, 1861, when secession occurred within the Confederacy, what was to become the Confederacy? I mean, it's not like it was hunky dory. People weren't just getting along. So anyway, this is what happened, and most of it had to do with economics. I mean, that's ultimately what it was. You know. The Americanism, really pushed by Hamilton, then through Henry Clay, and then through the Radical Republicans and Abraham Lincoln. So it was a lot about plunder.
This is the Whig American system, right? The Whig Party, the American system.
Yeah, and it was actually called the American system, right? Thomas DiLorenzo writes about it. And, you know, high tariffs, they're not, you know, evenly split among the regions of the country. And, then, you know, people are feeling just like they felt in the 1770s, that they were not being represented because they were having to expend more money and more of their labor to be a part of the system. So when this whole thing they acceded to didn't seem to be working for them, you know, they decided to secede. And then on top of that, the South was very wealthy. I can't just spout off a bunch of statistics, but I will say that the Radical Republicans didn't want the South because it was filled with a bunch of poor people who had nothing. The opposite was true. They wanted their stuff, right? So anyway, secession happened, the war, you know, occurred for 4 years. And, you know, Robert E. Lee, one of the things that he was beloved was that he wanted to forgive and forget. You know, we are Americans now. We tried our best. We're going to come back in and we're all going to be Americans. So a lot of people will say, well, he was against the battle flag. Well, actually, toward the end of his life, I've read some of his stuff. It was basically like, I thought this whole reconciliation thing was going to work. And I mean, he didn't live that long after the war. He died in like his early 70s. But, you know, I think he started to see the writing on the wall.
Didn't he have some correspondence with the Lord Acton?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And the famous line is, what, America's going to be tyrannical at home and despotic abroad. And, you know, then Acton agreed. So, you know, okay. Then you've got all of Reconstruction. They say it ended in the 1870s, but it really didn't. But let's just think a little bit about what it is. Entire towns were wiped off the map. I mean, gone. Everything burned. You know, Sherman's bummers, that's one of the things his bummers did, was to go in and get rid of everything. So think of just the destruction alone, much less the loss of the men, things stolen from people, you know, people who had nothing. The people who survived came out of it having nothing. So, you know, and then the Freedmen's Bureau comes in and then is going to put Black people who had recently been freed in positions of power in places where, in some places, you had to vote Republican or you didn't vote at all. And then in other places, I mean, white Southerners who, and Black Southerners too, any Southerner who fought for the Confederacy was disenfranchised, and there was military occupation within the South. So this is what's happening in the early parts of the war. So you have poor people now competing for jobs with, you know, poor white people, poor Black people, people who have lost everything, people who are angry for a variety of reasons, right? And then, you know, you can't let people vote. And then they have to come in and sign these loyalty clauses. Like, it was a train wreck. So anyway, that happened for a couple of decades. And then let's fast forward to the 20th century. Okay. Early 20th century, blue and gray started meeting like battlefields and breaking bread. And this is when the whole monument thing started coming up. And this is when like Mount Rushmore got built, late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah. It's also one of the, consequences or phenomena coming out of the Spanish-American War was this idea of former Confederates fighting alongside Yankees to go, you know, defeat the Spanish Empire and seize its holdings in the Caribbean and, of course, in the Pacific. And there's one account I read where it was in Cuba, and there, I guess it was during the charge of San Juan Hill, and one former Confederate who is now an elderly but old enough to fight said when they're shooting at the Spaniards, they go, let's go shoot those damn Yankees.
Yeah.
That's how he like couldn't help himself. But yeah, someone said that was one of the benefits of the Spanish-American War was this sort of a galvanizing effect. Yes. That it had, healing, notwithstanding the fact it was a war of aggression, fomented by, you know, some weird bombing of the Maine and Van Arbor and America's descent into a sort of overseas blue water empire. And of course, that would have consequences, reverberations, because one of the reasons why we eventually found ourselves in the war in the Pacific was America's ambitions in the Pacific. And that's how we ended up going against the Japanese, you know, 50 years later or 43 years later. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, and the war that you were just talking about, you know, where they're in Cuba and they're, you know, basically acting like Yankees. And that's another thing that Southerners, to kind of get pulled back in, they had to adopt this nationalistic, not in a good way, mindset. And, you know, I think the overarching deal for early 20th century reconciliation, we're going to let you have your monuments. You know, you can fly your flags, you can call yourself the rebels and play your banjos and eventually, you know, listen to Skinner or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you're going to fight our wars, you're going to pay your taxes. And, you know, you're just going to stay in line. You know, we're going to let you have just a little bit of this thing that is called, you know, your heritage, but, you know, not too much.
And Hollywood will make Birth of a Nation for you too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, yeah. So I actually critiqued Gone with the Wind with my friend Thomas Millery recently. Mm-hmm. And even looking back at these old movies that a lot of us grew up thinking were pro-Southern, you can see the Hollywood imprint on it, where it's like, it's just, you know, it's just enough, but, you know, you got to know your place as well. And then politicians in the 20th century as well, you know, they would go to Washington and be big government. And why? Because they would want to bring the bacon home for their people. They knew what was up. You know, they understood. And then, you know, a lot of them became Dixiecrats eventually, but they knew what was up. Like, we lost. This is the new game. Like, we can play by our old game, or we can do this and to help our people back home. And at that point, before the 1965 Immigration Act, it was their people back home. You know, I mean, they had constituents that they really represented in it. That's why they would bring the pork back home for them. So, anyway, yeah, and then in my opinion, the whole 20th century was basically like a crazy psyop. And now here we are here with Reconstruction, like in the latter stages. And it's not just tearing down monuments, but, you know, it's telling people that they're horrible because of who they are and where they came from and what they look like, and digging up dead people. Like, I've been to 2 reinterments. I went to the Nathan Bedford Forrest reinterment and the AP Hill reinterment. I mean, just think about that. That's a strange world to live in, where you've been to reinterments of people who, you know, they're dug up, not because their families wanted them to be. It's because people hated them and were going to dig them up and rip apart their corpse if they could. So this is the world we live in. This is the Reconstruction now. This is the one that has gotten people killed and will continue to do so. And it's all because the South is the scapegoat. It's the archetype for everything bad. You know, we've got conspiracy theorists, we've got anti-jab people, we've got all this, but it all kind of comes neatly and nicely together when you talk about a Southerner and a lost causer or a neo-Confederate, because that at all kinds of means the same thing. You know, a gun nut, doesn't hate himself for being white, etc., etc. So I hope I kind of answered your question. That was a lot in
no, it's one good
bit, but yeah.
See, yeah, this sort of war on Southern culture that we've seen, oh, I think overtly for probably 30, a little over 30 years now, and just it's accelerated. You know, obviously something like the Dylann Roof incident, where that becomes a pretext to start banning Southern paraphernalia, you know, taking down flags. You mentioned, of course, Southerners, you know, the governor of South Carolina, who's I think she's Indian, her ethnicity or her background, but she's Nikki Haley, and she just takes down the flag and ho hum, take down the statues. Of course, we had the incident in Charlottesville, you know, back in 2017. Of course, I think the actual reason for the protest was people protesting the removal of statues, and it was a permitted protest. And I guess you could say the carpetbagger or scalawag government in Charlottesville set them up. And that became sort of a mini January 6th pretext. Just this recent, I think there were more indictments handed down for people who had the audacity to carry a torch the night before.
The torches, right.
And they're trying to say that there's a law against burning crosses in someone's yard or something. And the prosecutor's trying to construe that into tiki torches.
Six years later.
And so I guess this goes to show that the people who are now in charge no longer even have respect the spirit of the laws. They're using it as sort of they're almost like Bolsheviks, where they're using the power of the state to smash everything. They don't care how bad it looks. They don't care about the optics anymore.
Yeah, it's anarcho-tyranny, like St. Francis said. I mean, you know, it's anarchic because nobody knows what's going on, but it's tyranny because it's used by some people to, you know, terrorize others. And it's not equal justice under the law. It's not common law. It's not British common law heritage. It's nothing like that, you know, and it's bad news. Yeah.
But what they've done and what they're finding out now is something like we have recruitment for the military it's like only like 63-64% now of their goals. Yeah. Well, because you've spent the better part of a decade insulting the core group that's going to fill the ranks, that's going to be patriotic and also be very capable. when it comes to these things.
Yeah.
And then they're wondering, and they're pushing all the wokeism. I just saw an ad today for the, I think it was the Navy, and it was a transvestite, a transgender, or sorry, a drag queen, and he's apparently in the Navy, but he's also a drag queen, and that's supposed to be a recruitment. Now that's just insane.
Yeah. Well, I wrote an article a few years ago called "If You Don't Want Us, We Don't Want You," and it's when they started the naming commission, started with all the getting rid of the military bases, you know, Fort AP Hill,
yes,
and Hood, and all this kind of thing. And you know, I mean, I wasn't the first to say this. Other Southern dissidents had been saying it for a long time, because a lot of Southern dissidents I know are former military, and they're just, you know, that went to VMI and whatnot, and they're just like, no, not one more drop of blood. None. We're not doing anything for you. So I was just, you know, echoing that sentiment, because it's like, why would you fight for this empire that hates you, you know? And the whole, you know, the military thing of, you know, we're fighting for liberty, and, you know, so you're safe at home, and we have to fight them over there, so we don't have to fight them over here. I mean, at this point, with drag queen Navy commercials, I mean, 2% of the population believe that. I mean, nobody believes that anymore. People go into the military because it's a jobs program. That's mm-hmm. why. Or it's a fast track to citizenship. That's why.
Well, that's interesting, because that signals sort of collapse, because the core ethnic group, the of America, which is its heritage America, the ethnic white America, seems to be the only group that seems to support the ideas, the propositions supposedly define the nation, meaning, right. You know, but then again, if that's the case, then these propositions ultimately are ethnically based. Right. And you start, you mentioned, of course, the 1965 Hart-Celler, the Immigration Reform Act, which began sort of the flow of non-whites, the selection of non-whites over, let's say, up until then, Europeans were the primary immigrants coming to the country. And that changed in 1965. Of course, when they passed that law, they claimed that it would not change the country's demographics. So at least at that
point, Teddy Kennedy promised that.
Yes. So there was some awareness that demographics mattered. And say, well, you know, now right. It's almost if you recognize that demographics matter, you're a racist.
Right.
You know, like Tucker Carlson just talks about the Great Replacement, and all of a sudden the ADL goes after him and eventually gets him fired. That was probably one of the reasons why he was canned at Fox. But the thing is, they themselves promote the Great Replacement as a good thing, the Browning of America. The emergent brown majority, colored majority versus the whites becoming a plurality of a minority in the country they founded. To them, it's a good thing. But if you mention it, then you're a racist. So there's your gaslighting there.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, of course, the year before the Immigration Act was the Civil Rights Act. So if I was being recorded video, I would put air quotes around that. Right.
Yes.
So, so it was like the double whammy, you know, of, it's instituting anarcho-tyranny. You know, it's not just the Great Replacement, but even for people who were born here, you know, some people are going to be have rights, and some people are not, you know. And so as opposed to, oh, you know, fixing the problems and, you know, dealing with the national sin, blah, 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 you know, all this kind of stuff, which, you know, I would debate whether there was a national sin at all anyway. And second, you know, by giving some people, you know, getting rid of meritocracy, you know, just wasn't the way to do it. So, you know, this great social engineering experiment, and I think they knew exactly what they were doing, you know, they just wanted to rip it apart and rip it to shreds. But the funny part is, it's going to tear apart the empire. So actually, it's going to come back and bite the butt of the people who thought, you know, these elitists that thought this was going to be some grand plan to get them votes and get them power. I mean, temporarily, but, you know, they'll have their comeuppance.
Well, yeah, I guess they figure artificial intelligence will fill the breach.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I just saw an article yesterday, I think it was in the Washington Post, that the problem with artificial intelligence is that it's racist because it relies on logic and pattern recognition.
Right.
There and so they go. Have to change. They have to change the algorithm. So it's not even supplying reliable information. this has something to do with mortgages and credit. Certain groups have poorer credit than other groups, and
right.
it must be racism. So basically, pattern recognition is racism. Well, yeah, okay, you want to call it that. Same with with the crime statistics and other things. It was a Pete Buttigieg, our transportation secretary, whose only qualification is that he's a homosexual.
Right.
Recently said that he was concerned because of traffic fatalities, rather, and pedestrian fatalities disproportionately affect people of color.
Right.
Again, this is a problem of racism, or it could be a matter of behavior and not following crosswalks or traffic laws, and something I observe every day when I'm driving around.
Right.
Certain groups aren't as cautious as when they're driving, or respectful, or follow the rules. Same with walking the street. But then again, it's all Whitey's fault, apparently, if there's some sort of disparity, because the presumption is we're all equal, right?
Right. It's interesting. They don't want you to pay attention to anything around you. They don't want you to use your eyeballs, your common sense at all. And of course, like you said, pattern recognition, that is what separates us from, rando animals, that we can see, oh, if I touch this red thing right here and get burned, it's fire. Like, stop touching that red thing, because you're going to get burned. People can, stereotype and see patterns, and it doesn't make you any kind of ist. It just means that you're a human being, because that's how we categorize these things in our mind. And that's how we learn. It's called learning. But on the flip side, of course, and I'm just pointing out what you already know, they want you to pay attention all the time. And if you see a Black coworker, well, they want you to wash his feet or whatever, mm-hmm. So it's like, on one hand, they don't want you to see it, but they do. And, that whole gaslighting is just part of the psychological torture. I think it's part of the psyop, and I think it's meant to drive people to despair, because there are no dummies, these elites, the regime, whatever, they understand how it goes. They're human beings too. And I really think it is part of just a way to drive us, to make us feel so depressed and alone and atomized and all that, that we just throw up our hands and we're like, whatever. And that's why, I do what I do, in some part, because I don't want to say whatever, and I'm raising three children, and I don't have the luxury to say whatever. Not what I would even want to do it if I didn't have kids, because no human should live a life like that. So that's why I try to just, be a cultural critic. And I'm dissident just because I'm nothing special. I'm just call out things the way I see it, and that happens to be in opposition to everything fashionable and in opposition to the status quo. So, I mean, by definition, that would make anyone a dissident, honestly.
Well, there's a tweet I just read. Joe Biden, well, I don't think he sent the tweet. His handle sent the tweet. He's probably napping or eating ice cream. But he sent a tweet out that said, Muslim culture has been woven throughout American culture from the very start. What? No, it hasn't.
No.
It's very little to do with American culture and its institutions. It's alien. And that's why they're having a call to prayer calls in Minneapolis now. People are like, what's that? I understand that, but it's got nothing to, it's not Western.
In fact, no. It's
really opposite Western. In fact, Western civilization held it off, as late as, 1683, I think was the last time they were at the gates of Vienna, and the Poles saved the day, the Polish cavalry, if anything. But that's just the sort of this mindless, pandering to multiculturalism. It's an insult to the nation's culture. It takes everything for granted. Just like when Joe Biden was talking about the relentless stream of non-white people into the country, and the fact that my own ethnic group will be a minority one day. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Well, why is it a good thing?
Yeah.
And why is that a good thing? That are we bad? And so why are you celebrating? And I think in the video that when he says that, which people have seen, have you seen that video? when he's saying
of him just saying that the stream of
there was unrelenting stream of you know, of course now his administration has just opened the floodgates, right? Completely complete abrogation of their responsibility. They have to enforce the laws. They're not. And in that video, I think Alejandro Mayorkas is behind him or beside him. And he's now, of course, the director of Department of Homeland Security overseeing immigration. He's just not enforcing. He's, of course, he comes from a group that actually wants to just disintegrate the country further, weaken the majority, because his people do very well in that. At least he thinks they do very well in that scenario where a majority is sort of atomized or you know, done away with through mass immigration. This whole thing, the same thing's occurring in Europe, throughout Europe. Ireland is a good example where it's being inundated with its Irish people are becoming aliens in their own country. And that's done deliberately. And this type of thing doesn't happen organically. No. At least not what we're saying. It's being done deliberately. It's social engineering. It's through NGOs and governmental bodies. And they're illegally shipping tens of thousands of people around the country, dumping them in small towns and saying, oh, well, I mean, how do you think Ilhan Omar got elected in Minneapolis?
Right.
Do you think people from Somalia walked to Minneapolis?
You know, right. It's like because anything, it's not just being white, but and of course, on the flip side, you know, you'll have CNN reporters say, well, what is white? That's not even a thing. Well, it is when you've put these people who meet these certain characteristic traits right smack dab in the crosshairs. Yeah, that becomes white. Yes. You know, 20 years ago, I didn't walk around calling myself a white person. I was just a person. You know what I mean? People would say that was privilege, but it's not. It's just that, you know, people were just doing their thing. And honestly, I think race relations 20, 30 years ago were, oh my gosh, astronomically better than they are now.
Well, there is some optimism because you still had sort of the ideal of the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
I think you and I both know that it isn't what it was or how it's portrayed. But most people thought, okay, we're getting better and, you know, there's improvement and, you know, the legal restrictions are gone. And if we just get rid of the legal restrictions, every black person is going to be Sidney Poitier. You
know? Right. Exactly.
Well, you know, that's Hollywood. I mean, you can enjoy To Kill a Mockingbird. You can enjoy Guess Who's Coming to Dinner or The Heat of the Night. And these things, these are movies. These are narratives that are spun. But if you watch those, they're not very complimentary towards Southern culture.
Right.
But it is spinning a narrative. And within those narratives, you do have sympathy for the characters.
Yeah, even To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, I'm not a huge fan of that book. You know, and I honestly think Harper Lee, you know, from what I've researched, people didn't think she was that much of, they didn't think she was that great of a writer. And then there were some, you know, New York people who said, hey, well, we'll think you're a really great writer. You know, we're not going to tell you everything to say, but this is kind of the narrative or the blueprint that we want you to push through. And then now, of course, it's being canceled because it uses speech that people find intolerable.
That's, I'm like, well, wait a second. If you don't have the word, how are you going to have, I mean, it loses its effect,
even
from their standpoint. It's propaganda effect from their standpoint. But it is. It's almost like a 20th century version of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good way to put it. Yeah. But I mean, so and now they're eating their own or whatever. So when people bemoan, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird is being canceled, I'm just like, whatever, throw it on the pile, set it aflame. Yeah. Who cares?
When you talk about something, an issue of like interracial rape, or a sexual assault, or that accusation. Of course, in the book, it's a white girl who's pining for the affections of a strong black man, right?
Yeah.
How often is that really the case?
Yeah.
And what's the other narrative? Just remember, what was that movie, Time to Kill?
Mm-hmm.
Where, of course, it was based on a true story. And of course, the Hollywood
Matthew
version.
Matthew McConaughey?
Yes.
That one? Okay, yeah.
The Hollywood version is two rednecks rape and leave a black girl for dead.
Yeah.
And the father, in a fit of rage, shoots her assailants and wounds a deputy. In the process, he's put on trial for murder, that sort of thing. He's acquitted, that sort of thing. And everyone celebrates. It takes place at the time in the 90s, but it treats the Southern town like it's a Southern town in the early 60s or something. But it was based on a true story. But the true story was two white girls being raped by a black guy.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
So
Yeah. Well, so, and now, you know, a little girl gets raped by two men and people just think that's public school.
Yeah.
That's just she consented because, you know, kids need to be with adults. I mean,
and the UN now is endorsing that now.
Right. Yeah. The study, oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. World Health Organization.
Well, listen, too. Like you said, I've heard people argue that if you endorse the idea that children can decide to change their sex, you know, they really can't, but that to undergo that treatment, that surgery, right, that the mutilation, they can certainly decide to engage in sexual relations with adults as well.
Right.
You know, that's one thing you never see. Well, I mean, come on. If anything, I said that the sex reassignment surgery is far more traumatic and irreversible than any, you know, sexual trauma that a child may experience. Theoretically, a child can recover from that, you know, right, in a way, and live a normal life. Right. But this is way far horrible, more horrible than that. I mean, if you were to hear a case of an offender, or someone molesting a child, then mutilating her or him, we'd be outraged by it. But that person happens to be a doctor, then it's okay.
Correct.
You know,
it's interesting. Back in 2019, I wrote a whole bunch of articles on, this was when the drag queen stuff was just becoming, like, it was just kind of simmering under the surface and happening at just a few libraries. And that kid Desmond was dancing for everybody. And that's when, this was all when my niece decided she was a boy, and I had all this familial trauma with it, whatever. But I wrote a two-part series called Pedophilia is Progress. And it goes, you know, it's always been about diddling kids, always, mm-hmm, always, always. And it's always been about tearing out age of consent laws. I mean, that's always what it's been about, you know. So all this talk about freedom and, you know, the Stonewall riots and all that kind of stuff. And, you know,
that's more civil rights mythos.
Right.
You know, that's like Stonewall was our time. We're in the street. That was just like, it's the 60s. I know they're romanticizing street protest or anti-war movement, the civil rights protest idea that in the streets you know that's how you assert yourself. But of course, that's only if you're on the left. Right. If you're on the right and you're doing that, or you're at Charlottesville, you're
right,
protesting on behalf of, you know, Donald Trump at January 6th, or you're a pro-life advocate, you don't get the same treatment.
Right.
You know, and so all of a sudden, you know, civil disobedience, or even any act of disobedience or violence on the street, the book will be thrown. This is where, you know, anarcho-tyranny isn't, that's anarcho-tyranny, because they're not like these prosecutors, these Soros prosecutors, they're not soft on crime, they're soft, right, on certain crime. But if you, and you're, if you're on the wrong side of the political aisle, and you go out and do something, it doesn't even have to be illegal. They'll make it illegal, you know, like waltzing through the Capitol building.
And that's one of the things that the whole neocon proposition nation and America is an idea thing that the neocons push. And, you know, they have, you know, we watch Mark Levin and he has a picture of, you know, or a statue of Lincoln behind him. Well, they're all mad. You know, they have their conservative spidey senses are all tingling because, you know, there's a double standard. Well, mm-hmm, you know, there has to be an agreement upon laws and rules. And I don't just mean laws and legal. I mean, like, universal laws, or natural law, rather, because you would like to think killing somebody randomly for sport or whatever is like a universal bad thing. But you can see in America, that is just not the case. You know, people celebrate John Brown. I see people all the time on Twitter, you know, lauding John Brown, who was a murderous freak show.
Yeah.
You know, but meanwhile, James Fields is in prison on four life sentences plus a gazillion years for hate crimes and whatever, because Heather Heyer had a heart attack. You know, I mean,
yes.
Yes. And it's like, we don't have, there's no proposition because nobody can even agree on anything. And there's no idea because everybody has ideas that are changing all the time. The only thing that roots us is tradition, is something that took time to unfold organically, right? Now, I don't like diversity by force, but you and I have already discussed how the South was pretty diverse naturally and organically over a 400-year span, mm-hmm, and it was doing its thing because things were small and local, size and scope. You know, Louisiana was, New Orleans was extremely diverse, but it was still under that ethos of being New Orleans, the state of Louisiana, right? Being in something called this region of the South that wasn't Boston. It was something different, but it worked because it unfolded organically. You know,
but
that's
it wasn't
why when,
perfect. It wasn't right. perfect.
And you're never going to have that, you know, and it's mm-hmm. always one side or the other, you know, the middle path, not compromise, but the middle path, that's the royal path. That's the one where you understand the flaws of human beings and the limitations you have to do things. And you try to choose the path that celebrates and upholds and nurtures the traditions, but you have to, you know, pivot in a way that moves you down the track so you don't get gobbled up in the process either, you know. So there's no clear understanding to what that's going to be. And I've read a lot of treatises on secession, a lot of books, a lot of articles, listened to a lot of podcasts, had conversations with people. I mean, nobody knows for sure. There's no prescription because what works in some place may not work in another. And at a different time, it could work here and not there. But smaller's always better. Size and scope, decentralization is always better than an empire that hates you and wants you dead.
Yeah, but how could a decentralized constitutional little government America have saved the world from Nazism and communism? See, that's the important of historical narrative, because people buy into those narratives, right? And they think history begins in 1941, or it begins in 1949 or something with the Cold War. Well, we're never stopping to think that, of course, the crises that we're facing today is a consequence of previous intervention and meddling.
Right.
Right. Good example is if you want to buy in the narrative of the Second World War, okay. But that wouldn't happen if America stayed out of the First World War.
Right. And the Second World War is what, I mean, really put Globo Homo on the ascent.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons for that. That's the
was the beginning of the end.
Yeah,
and that's
people,
why my father calls me a pinko commie.
Some people call it the Nuremberg regime. That's a good phrase, because all the congealed propaganda that was developed at war and actually became more extreme after the war, particularly after the 1970s. Again, if you look at the historiography of the Second World War in the 50s and 60s, it's very different than, let's say, post 1970. That speaks to sort of what occurred in the 20th century America was the ascendancy of Jewish power, of course, in America, and sort of the supplanting of the WASP elite that occurred in the middle part of the 20th century, growing out of the Second World War narrative. There's a lot that goes into that. But obviously in America, the 20th century, those who controlled the American state wanted the American century. And this was at the time was sort of a WASP thing with Henry Luce, Time Life, mm-hmm. and these things. But I guess the after 1950s, you have, again, growing Jewish power, particularly with the development. You know, technology is interesting because, you know, the Civil War, right? At least how it unfolded, it couldn't happen without the telegraph or railroad, right?
Mm-hmm.
You had a secession crisis in 1820s, 1830s, and the federal government simply didn't have the power to prevent secession, so it had to negotiate. Right. But then you have technology sets in, and then in the 20th century, of course, you have mass media, first radio, then of course movies and Hollywood, and then broadcast television, and that's a game changer. That's a force multiplier in propaganda. And, you know,
and that people believed it too. I've actually a
yes,
long time ago.
That's the way it is. Walter Cronkite, right?
Yeah. It was one of the first, it was probably like the first or so year of me blogging. So this was back in like 2017. And as a journalism major, you know, I actually had some decent teachers back in the day. And, you know, the whole myth of objectivity and that, you know, everybody wasn't writing something through their biases and through the lens of their own experiences and whatnot. And, you know, newspapers back in, you know, the 1700s and 1800s, you know, if you wanted to say something, you bought a newspaper and, you know, you pummeled the other guy rhetorically, you know.
Yeah, they were partisan broadsheets. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and this is just what people did. Nobody bought newspapers back then or pamphlets and thought they were going to be unbiased and fair and balanced. No, they bought the red meat that they wanted, and that's what they did. So that it was a whole myth created in the 20th century, you know, after the yellow journalism wars and all this kind of thing, to have people think that, oh, I'm going to open it up and it's going to be truth. And like,
well, think about it, the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
Pulitzer was a yellow journalist.
Absolutely.
Same with, with the other guy, you know, Hearst.
Yeah. Hearst. Yeah, and everybody knew that, but somewhere along the way, and again, I think World War II had a lot to do with this, where, you know, you don't want to believe that you're being lied to, you know, and that's one reason I said it earlier, and I don't know if you heard me, like, I got in a disagreement with my dad years ago when we were talking about World War II, and I was talking about, like, the Pat Buchanan take of maybe it was an unnecessary war, maybe it caused more trouble than it was worth, and maybe what we're living through now is a consequence of it all, you know. And he called me a pinko commie, and I was like, Dad, you're the one who's, like, you know, cheering for the side that actually allied with Stalin, you know that, right? But you're just pinko commie, you know. But these are the people that would fly a battle flag beside their U.S. flag and had no qualms doing that. But that was that whole, like you said, the American century, that was just what they knew. And I get that it's a bitter pill. And that's why we pick on boomers, because they don't want to admit that they had the wool pulled over their eyes for their entire lives. I mean, it's really, it's
well, what does George Orwell say about, you know, the idea of entertaining or holding two contradictory beliefs simultaneously?
I don't know. What did he say?
Something to that effect. 1984. Oh. So this is it. This is, you know, This is the propaganda, you know. We've always been at war with East Asia, right?
Say it again. I was laughing too hard. What?
Yeah, we've always been at war with East Asia, you know.
Yeah.
Yesterday we were allies with them. That's, he was, of course, writing about the sort of the switcheroos during the Second World War.
Yeah.
At that time. But yeah, I mean, you realize, you know, the advance of global communism was part of the American war effort, you know, with Lend-Lease. It was financed through Lend-Lease. And of course, mm-hmm. prior to that, the Bolshevik Revolution was financed by, you know, Jewish New York financiers.
Americans, the Yankees. Yeah. See, it's always Yankees causing trouble everywhere.
Well, it's funny because you have this Yankee thing, like the Yankee impulse, and they became, you know, the Transcendentalists and the Unitarians, and they lost their faith. And of course, mm-hmm. the Pilgrims no one could get along with the Pilgrims, right? That's why they left. Yeah, you know, and right. That's an outgrowth of the English Civil War. And ultimately, the English Reformation, right. You know, and so these things reverberate right throughout history. And just like has the American Civil War, some people say, was a continuation of the English Civil War.
Yeah,
you know? Mm-hmm. That's that book. I think Albion Seed writes about that in that book.
Yes,
Albion Seed,
a fascinating book. Yes. Fascinating book, and it's we did it on audiobook, but it's. It's intense. I mean, you mm-hmm. think you know America. I mean, it's just a fascinating book.
Yeah, as a Catholic, when I think of the Southerner, we'll look at Sherman, right?
Right.
And because that an Irish Catholic will look at Cromwell. Mm-hmm. And both were, you know, so it's kind of the same thing. It is, again, people have these again, they're fed all this propaganda, and it works if they're kept dumb. And that's what right. the media was designed to do. I mean, the modern media, the Second World War, it was all grew out of the psychological warfare branch of the U.S. government. That was the Office of War Information, OSS. I think William Paraly came from that. Sarnoff came from that. Walter Cronkite came from those alphabet soup agencies. And even Edward R. Murrow, right? He's this famous journalist, and this is England. The guy was an actor, mm-hmm. you know, and they would break in the shows, you know, and this was studied like with the Princeton Radio Project with War of the Worlds and Orson Welles.
Okay.
That was all a program.
Right.
That was designed to test the impact of mass media and the impact of traumatizing mass media. Could they produce a fake story and judging what the results would be? And so mass media was heavily researched primarily, some by corporations, but just primarily the War Department, then the Defense Department, and the CIA. So mass media developed along with mass psychological warfare. It's all a function of that, to one degree or another, you know.
Absolutely. And that's what keeps people, abiding by the laws, even when we do live in lawless times, you know. And I was just thinking, you know, something like a very Jeffersonian principle like nullification. Federal government can do this thing that they want that we don't want in this small polity over here, this state or this county or whatever. It can just not be enforced. I mean, we experienced a lot of that all under COVID, depending on where you live. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a mandate from the governor, or, you know, Trump or Biden say this thing, but we all went plenty of places where people were just not doing that.
Yes.
So, you know, those are Jeffersonian principles, you know, come and enforce it, right? You know, like, you can pass this stuff all day long, but it still requires local enforcement, and people maybe don't even need to be enforced if they just go along with it. But if people just stop going along with it, that can go a long way too. That could be a very, you know, nationalistic thing to do, as like in, you know, a Southern nationalistic, mm-hmm. or, you know, a Pacific Northwest thing, you know, or how the people in, what is it, Eastern Oregon and Washington that want to leave and become part of Idaho, you know, those are things that, you know, can be done now on smaller levels. Anytime, you know, I call homeschooling personal secession. I've always said that, mm-hmm. because it is, you're withdrawing from a system, a government education system, and you're choosing to do something else. Now, it happens to be illegal, but when homeschooling first started, it wasn't. And it just took brave people to be like, we're just going to keep doing it, you know, sorry. So we can do things like that in so many regards all the time.
Yeah, well, the homeschooling movement, which has exploded, it was born out of an illegal act in violation of state laws. And so many people were doing it, they just had to back down. Then they tried to regulate it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Mass resistance, right? As the Southerners might call it. It's also, it matters, like, obviously the whole of the COVID stuff, it mattered greatly who your governor was and who your mayor was, the city council and these things. And simply not just not participating is a big thing.
And even businesses, like what grocery store you go to, you know, like.
Well, that was the push towards that's the push towards centralization, because as BlackRock buys up everything, big corporations buy up everything, they can impose their ESG or this whole woke stuff top down.
Yeah.
And that's why the destruction of small businesses is so important, has the profound political and cultural effects on that, because that's a source of a lot of resistance and independence.
Yeah. Just small people who were, you know, whether it be the barber or the grocery store, you know, I go to a grocery store that's regional and it's a North Carolina company, but they're everywhere. And the one near me didn't enforce jack. You know, and mm-hmm. there were plenty of people in there doing their own thing, you know, wearing masks, not wearing masks. And I never wore a mask in there once, you know, mm-hmm. and it's just okay, because the manager just didn't feel like enforcing it. You know, it just came to a point where the person was like, no, just N-O period. No more. Well, I'm not doing it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would walk into a store and I had an easier time at the bigger stores. Because you're going to like a small store and you got a masked person in there, mm-hmm. it's like, okay, it's his store. Either I won't patronize you, or okay, I'm out of here. But I would go into like a large chain store and they say, "Where's your mask? Because I'm not wearing it. I'm fine. I just walk away."
Yeah.
And then they wouldn't do anything, because most people don't want a confrontation.
Yeah.
Occasionally, people in a store. Did you see those videotapes? Like up, it was just like in the during the I guess the mid. The summer of that of 2020, there's some lady that was hounded by a mob up in New York somewhere, mm-hmm. chased out of her store because she wasn't wearing a mask. It was like those people. This shows how crazy people can be driven.
Yeah,
aren't you wearing a mask?
Then, well, it is New York, you know.
Yeah, there you go. There's Yankees up there, there doing that. But yeah, you had sort of this. Now you know. Now we have this cult of diversity, and what you're seeing now is sort of the collapse of the Yankee Empire. We're seeing it, you know, we're seeing with the decline of the dollar and mm-hmm. some of its geopolitical maneuverings, particularly with Russia, where that, regarding Ukraine, has sparked a de-dollarization of the global economy, which what the Yankee Empire ultimately depends on,
right?
Because of they've weaponized the dollar, so people are going to start to dump the dollar and use some other means of international transaction. And perhaps this is chutzpah. They're just going too far. They don't know. And they've created a crisis that they can't control now. Because they started a war they can't win, apparently.
Well, I think it's just the hubris of the West in general. You know, the Yankee Empire, transatlanticism, whatever you want to call it. A lot of the world is moving on. And the U.S. and the West just don't have the respect and the chutzpah that we once had, that, you know, the power that either made people respect us, you know, or know that they had to bend to, you know, to progress themselves. And I just think so many parts of the world are moving on, you know.
Also,
China, India, Russia.
All the woke stuff. I mean, that's just perverse.
Right.
Where America is now celebrating child, you know, mutilation and molestation and all the queer transgender stuff, which is so bizarre and so odd. But that's like a number one cause for the federal government advancing that abroad. Yeah.
I mean, that's what Globo Homo is. It's not just homogenization. It's pushing that. You know, I remember reading years ago how the Republic of Georgia, you know, which, you know, has some, you know, they like the West to a degree and whatnot, but there was still like an Orthodox country, pretty conservative, that kind of thing. And these Orthodox bishops, you know, came to the ambassador. I don't know if it was Grinnell or whatever his name is, but it was somebody, one of his people. And this was under Trump, and said, you know, we don't want a gay pride parade here. And like the U.S. ambassador guy was like, you know, maybe not putting it on, but kind of like undergirding it and, you know, helping it move, you know, grease in the wheels or whatever.
Yeah.
And they were like, we don't want this. The people here don't want it. And they said, we don't care what you want. And they had like a gay pride parade, you know, and it's like the you know, this stuff is foisted on people. And it's interesting because, like, you know, Russia, you know, having a Orthodox Renaissance, but, you know, you have people there digging themselves out of 70 years of Soviet communism. So there are some people there that are susceptible to this, and they just think America is so cool and all this kind of stuff. Well, a lot of them have left. Like a lot of these YouTubers that all they do is sit around all day long and talk about how bad Russia is. Like they left. All the like anti-Putin journalists have gone. So it's really interesting, like what's happening in Russia right now, because, you know, obviously they're in opposition to this Globo Homo. They don't want to be under, you know, NATO's thumb. They want to do their own thing, have their own sphere of influence. But a lot of the people who were within trying to pull them down left after the invasion a year ago. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens there culturally, you know, if they let them back in or what, or if these people never want to come back in. I don't know. It'll be really interesting to see.
Yeah, how it plays out. Apparently, I think I read somewhere that Zelensky was offering Poland huge chunks of Western Ukraine in return for support.
Right.
You know, thinking, well, I thought this was done to protect Ukrainian sovereignty and borders. And now they're.
Oh, yeah.
Because historically, Poland has laid claim to that region. I think it's Galicia or something. So there's Ukraine's a frontier, and of course the further east you go in Ukraine, the more Russian you get, you know, and it's historically been a part of Russia, particularly Odessa and the Crimea, these areas. To think that NATO can push all the way there without getting some sort of pushback, it was highly provocative, and most people can see that. But it just relentless advance, you know, since the 1990s eastward was going to provoke Russia, you know. But again, that goes, I think there's a longstanding strategy in the West regarding Russia and Germany. It's the Mackinder Doctrine, you know, the perimeter, the sea power versus the land power, which ultimately led to, you know, the 30 Years' War in the 20th century. We call it World War One or World War Two, was to idea was of NATO was to keep Germany down and the Russians out. And they don't want Germany and Russia working together, which is why you have, you know, pipelines being blown up and economic interdependence. You say you aren't dependent on Russia for natural gas. Well, then you're making dependent on us for much more expensive liquefied natural gas that we can't supply. And at the same time, they're decommissioning their nuclear power plants. So now German industry, which is sort of the, you know, the backbone of Europe, of the European economy, always has been. And now they're trying to destroy it. And yeah, and then you get this weird green agenda where they're trying to destroy industrial society, and they have no real feasible or reliable substitutes for things like internal combustion engine and oil. They think they can just power green power to pay for it all. I mean, to supply the energy. Well, actually, it doesn't, because what they're envisioning is ultimately a massive population reduction and a return, you know, to something like the Middle Ages in terms of technology for most people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's my kids are taking the science class, and we were just talking about it the other day. And we listened to The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels on audiobook a couple of years ago. That's Alex Epstein. He's like a secular Jew, not a non-practicing Jew, but he actually has this very like Christian perspective on environmentalism, because he's looking at it from a human perspective. And the whole book is just talking about how, okay, you know, you can love plants and animals, you can love land, you can love clean water, but environmentalism, what it is today and it has been for a long time, is anti-human. It is not about human flourishing or health. You know, so it literally, these NATO people don't care if, you know, people are cold in the winter, or, you know, little grandma freezes in the winter, because that's just one less person on the dole to them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's anti-human. And that's why this is kind of like a roundabout back to the U.S. You know, there's a lot of people like in the Protestant world and in the Orthodox world and just in general, you know, probably some kind of you know, maybe Fox News kind of boomer who's just like, oh, don't bother with the culture war, and the culture war is over. And you're just, especially from a Christian perspective, oh, you know, it's you're being too worldly, and it's just, you're too political. No, I mean, I don't even call it a culture war anymore. It is an existential war, because when it comes to you wanting people to cease being, particularly my children, that's existential. Okay, of course, has cultural ramifications, but I mean, that is something much deeper. So even the term culture war becomes like this ridiculous term that they turn into like conspiracy theory and stuff like that, when there obviously is one, but it's something so much bigger. So just you talking about the pipeline and, you know, and how it's really about harming human beings and, you know, eating the bugs and you'll own nothing and be happy and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's true. It's absolutely true.
Yeah. I mean, I look at the Biden administration, the whole West, they're demolition teams at this point.
Yeah.
And whoever's in control of Germany, Ireland, these are alien governments. They don't even, I mean, they don't even notionally represent the people anymore. Same with the Biden administration. It was installed. I'm sorry. You know, and so they're kind of doing their job. So I wonder why they're making the world, you know, they impose like all this COVID nonsense, and they start a war right after that. And it's like, really, guys, can't you wait at least a year? But it's never a dull moment. They want constant crisis, and it's government by crisis and emergency powers and decrees and these things.
But and it's so much so fast. It is. I mean, I can't think of any better way to say than red pilling, but it's, you know, really tearing the scales off people's eyes.
Yeah, someone once observed that time is a way of making sure that things don't happen all at once. And when they do, there's an agenda, you know, I'm sorry. And you can look at something like Ukraine and Russia that could have been avoided so easily, and it wasn't on purpose. So it was fomented. It was created. Same thing with the COVID, the reaction to COVID, the nonsense, whatever you think of COVID. Whether you think there was a novel virus or, you know, it was whatever it was weaponized and manipulated, and it was an opportunity, you know, the Great Reset, Build Back Better, all this nonsense we heard for a year and a half. Now also we're not hearing it anymore. So there's something else. And then, you know, there'll be this net zero stuff, which is just insane. Net zero? Are you insane? emissions. And now we have to worry about nitrates and CS, you know, carbon monoxide or dioxide, rather. I mean, this is a 0.04% of the, I think it's 0.04% of the atmosphere. And then there's nitrates, you know, with fertilizer. This is all just a pretext to shut down agriculture. And then, they, of course, the same neoliberals, they've concentrated agriculture, corporatized it, made it, you know, made they've introduced toxins into the food, made meat less healthy and these things. And then they want to shut it all down. I mean, it's like with corporate farming, you know.
And, you know, this is a term that people are using more and more, but agrarianism. And that's another thing that is
the South.
Rooted in the Southern culture. Yes. You know, it didn't just mean, you know, a giant plantation with 200 slaves. Yes, that was part of it. But it meant people that understood nature and moved slowly because nature told them they had to do things in a way that they didn't have much control. This is when I talk about the South being Orthodox with a lowercase o.
Yes, they understood
they had a respect for nature and how you cannot speed things up, that there's a greater master than you, the human man.
There are seasons.
Yes, there are seasons. And this is one of the reasons a lot of Yankees said they were lazy and whatever, because they took time off. And honestly, there were some times that were too hot and they had to sit around, you know, like chilling out or whatever. But it also gave them downtime to write literature and create art and all this kind of stuff, which I think is one of the reasons the Southern arts are so rich and deep, because they not only took the time because it was hot, but they understood that you're just not here to work, busy bee, industry all the time, that you're supposed to enjoy the fruits of your labor and share them with your family and your neighbors and people you love. So there was that whole thing, but it all goes back to agrarianism. And I say this as a person that can like grow jalapenos, basil, and like okra. You know, like I'm not a great, you know, gardener. I'm not even a great cook. I've gotten to be over the years much better, but these are things that can tap you back to take you back to something eternal and beautiful. And, you know, the hospitality, you know, that's a biblical precept. These are all things that are Southern, but also very biblical and rooted and sensible. They make sense. And that's why, you know, people in some places aren't allowed to collect the rainwater even, or, you know, some places are taxing people for growing tomatoes and all this kind of silliness. And it's because of that, because something as simple seeming as having a 12 by 20 garden, it really is like an act of revolution, you know. So these are, this is another thing that can be a personal secession before the complete de-dollarization happens and the complete collapse comes. So you're at least prepared more than you would be.
Yeah, you're setting up a support mechanism, a system of distribution and trade that's outside the globalist system, which is inevitably going to collapse. Because it's unnatural and it's satanic.
Yeah, and somebody's got to grow something other than jalapenos, because I'm going to be the jalapeno farmer in town, and that's going to be my
eggs. Yeah,
that's right.
Well, I was listening to something. He was like, "Hey, have you heard about the price of eggs lately? It's ridiculous! Like $7 for a dozen." Yes, yeah, well, I didn't know that. Says I buy them from a local farmer. They've stayed the same price.
Yeah.
So he's out, see, right there. He's outside, sort of the because there was being produced because they weren't affected by the same shortage. Because, you know, I mean, they're killing a bunch of chickens. And by the way, they're claiming they have avian flu and they're using the PCR test. Oh, great. Yeah. This is the same BS test they used to create the pandemic. You know, asymptomatic chickens. They're killing asymptomatic chickens because of positive PCR tests.
Right.
Again, the importance of agrarianism in sort of keeping society rooted and literally, because, you know, if you have a society right now, was it less than 2% of the country is engaged in agriculture, I think, right now? Over 50%. Mm-hmm. Well, if you had a country that was like 20% agrarian, its politics would be far more conservative.
And it
would check the cities, the insanities of the cities. Because to a certain extent, the cities have always been sort of debauched and sinful. Whether it's New Orleans, but it didn't mean the entire state of Louisiana was that way. So these things had were sequestered and had their areas like New York or San Francisco. You know these things were always considered because you have sailors coming in and trade and that sort of stuff. So it was always considered a little risque, if you will. But now it's kind of like they radiate out and they impose it through technology and the media. These Hollywood played a big part in that, of course, in the 20th century. But the idea, you put a kid on, if you raise a few kids, they get exposure to say something on a farm with animal husbandry, you're never going to convince them that transgenderism is real.
Right.
Because they know how things work, right? It's like, and there's a function to it. There's a logos to it, right? There's a meaning to it,
Right. And a lot of people will say, oh, it's not, North versus South or Yankee versus Southern or, it's urban versus rural. Well, I would say that's the same thing because, that is what the war of Northern aggression was. It was forcing industrial capitalism down on an agrarian people who didn't want it. I mean, that was part of it too. So it's just that taking place in other, that could be taking place in Iowa or Wisconsin or whatever, but it's still the same template,
Yeah. And you'd like to think there'd be some sort of fusionism because obviously the farms, the agrarian areas can support the cities and vice versa, and they trade. The problem is those in the city gain a measure, as you develop a money economy, these things, then you have power, and then you get the rise of finance, and finance manipulates production. And now it's the point where finance is feeding off production, whether it's agricultural or manufacturing, and it's the entire U.S. economy has been overly financialized. It's the fire economy, as they say.
Yeah.
It's finance, insurance, and real estate, but there's no production. There's very little manufacturing. And now we're seeing that because that's why we're seeing the explosion of debt, which is a whole nother, I think they're driving the country off a cliff with just mountainous debt. And COVID, of course, greatly accelerated that, but sort of the wars and these things,
But now the savers are getting screwed too.
Yes.
so it's like, you can't win. And, the people who have the good credit scores are going to pay more for housing and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's just like,
Do you imagine the federal government actually having a program to encourage destructive behavior? Who would have thunk it?
Yeah, who would have thunk?
Exactly. I think that's been for the past 60, 70 years, it's been the score. Because it's no longer equality. You can't have that, really. Wait, people aren't equal. So now we need equity.
Right.
We have to, we need more persons of color flying airplanes. Why?
Right.
Because they don't do well. Well, that's, you want them to crash the planes? You want the bridges to collapse? You want the power grid to fail? Oh, they do. Okay, there you go.
Yeah, exactly.
So I said to have you for like an hour and a half. We're getting close to that. Now, okay. I know you mentioned your article. I got the book. It's The Honorable Cause, A Free South, 12 Southern Essays. So you're one of the 12 essays.
Correct.
And you're writing about orthodoxy as a sort of a religious basis for Southern identity in that article, correct?
Correct. And I'll tell you the title because it wasn't my working title and they changed it, which is fine. But I'll tell you the title if I get to it. Is The Orthodox Faith the Solution? Building Upon a Southern Ethnos Through True Faith. So it's the last chapter in the book before the conclusion by Padraig Martin, who was the gentleman who organized the people to do the writing. 11 people, and he's one of the 12. So he starts the book and then ends the book, but I'm the last chapter before that.
And that's I think it was published in April, in the commemoration of April, which is Confederate month, right?
Confederate History Month, yep.
That's important date, and that's the book. Yeah, I purchased the book. I read your essay, and I also read Edwards' introduction. He's been on his show, the Political Cesspool. I think he devote the entire month to promoting it or something.
Probably. Yeah. He's a great guy. But it's a really interesting book. I mean, that's what a pitch. It's interesting. Yeah. No, it's intriguing because, I mean, that's one of the great things about a collaborative effort. There was no coaching. Padraig didn't say, hey, everybody say these things, or here's a general view. He just said, give me a topic and tell me what it is so I can make sure nobody else is doing it. Mm-hmm. That was it. And it's interesting because it is the opinions are diverse. I mean, you're going to read some chapters and be pumping your fist into the air, other ones rubbing your chin, other ones you could get mad, you know? I mean, it's a very thought-provoking book, but there's still these overarching, this theme or these threads that run through that just happened. And I would like to say it's because we're all Southerners, you know, because we're all from different places in the South. You know, we all have our genealogy is, you know, all a little bit different, but it's because we were all steeped in being Southerners. So I think it's a fascinating read. It's a very good book.
And you argue for orthodoxy because, as someone once said, the South is haunted by Christ, but there's no clear, liturgy or doctrine to,
right,
to bind them. And in your opinion, orthodoxy provides that that unity. And right, ultimately ethnos, ethnic identity, you know.
Right. I mean, you know, if you talk about Russia right now, you know, or Russia 110 years ago, you know, you would call it an Orthodox country, right? Mm-hmm. You could for a while, you know, there's debate, but you could even have called America a Christian nation. I'm not a fan of the word nation, but, you know, like, you could have called it that. You could have seen the British Isle, different kinds of Christianity that came here and helped to settle it, from the Puritans to the Anglicans in Virginia. This is what we were talking about with Albion Seed. Mm-hmm. But these were disparate, very much not the same types of Christianity back then. And now not close. So you to have something cohesive, you have to share, you know, a worldview. You don't have to be carbon copies of each other, but you have to overwhelmingly share something. Well, part of the main element in nationhood, true nationhood, in my opinion, is Christianity, is religion. And so my thing would be, I make the case in my chapter that, you know, all sorts of great Christians from here, you know, wonderful, peaks and valleys of Christian thought and thinkers and movements and all these kinds of things. But because it was so kind of maybe elastic or whatever, you know, it just wasn't enough to bind. You know, it wasn't a tie mm-hmm. that bound, you know, ties that bind. That's the thing. It wasn't bound, you know? And then once you got, you know, the Yankee onslaught coming down, you know, pushing all their wackadoodle types of Christianity, whether you would even call some of those Christianity, not even Trinitarian in many cases, it just was a slow chipping away at it, to where, you know, I think still a lot of Southerners were called themselves Christians, but just kind of a name only. So there has to be something. We can have political successes. You can have all sorts of great personal successes. These can happen, but if you want something to be enduring, you know, it has to be built on the rock. So I am an Orthodox Christian. So I would, you know, I'm saying that go way far back to where we're all coming home to something that is what the apostles were doing. So that would be my thing. And that's not foreign. It's not Eastern, because if you're a Christian at all, you're going to be, you know, going back to Christ's time, you know, and then the people who spread the gospel from there and wrote the New Testament. So that is my take. And I use a lot of quotes from other people who saw this, some agrarians, you know, just other learned people that saw just, this was just a huge chink in the armor of the South. And some people say that the South lost before the first shot was fired, because even though it was becoming cohesive in opposition to Lincoln in his election in 1860, that it was still only temporary. And that's always a fun show. Like, if I've thought about doing this, like, Monday morning quarterbacking, what if the South had won? What would it have looked like? You know, so none of us really know. But I think it would have been a lot more enduring than what we have now. Absolutely, 100%. But my hope is that eventually those people who had won and carried forward the Confederate States of America would have eventually come to orthodoxy. I hope, because there was an Orthodox here, and there were actually, like, you know, Serbians that fought in the Confederacy and whatnot. So it wasn't the first Orthodox Church in the South. I may be getting this right. Is it in the whole East? Maybe it was. But anyway, there's a history to Orthodoxy here. It's not huge. I'm not saying that at all. I'm like Joe Biden said about the Muslims. I'm not saying that. I see it as the truth. So, nobody knows what would have happened to the CSA, but I see it as something that we have to have a shared faith. It's something. And that doesn't mean mass conversion or converting people at a gunpoint, but it means that has to be the ethos, right? How America, if it was a Christian nation, there were expectations that were formed through a Christian worldview. And that's how norms and culture unfolded. So it would be the same. Like if you went and lived in a Muslim country, you don't have to be Muslim, but by God, you better conform to what they're doing because that's their ethos. So, I mean, it happens in other places. It has happened here and it can happen again.
Yeah. And of course, those who are anti-Christian have no problem imposing their values and their ethos in law. You know, right. Everyone's religious to that extent, and yes. Someone's values are going to prevail. It's the idea of a neutrality of a neutral state is obviously untrue. It's an absurdity because someone's values prevail.
And that's why mass liberal democracy is so horrible because it's so giant. And then once you're in, you know, there's like very. I don't know if I want to say very few escape valves, but I mean, it's hard to escape. That's why smaller is better. Yeah. You know, that is just why it is better for human beings and human flourishing. And, you know, I wouldn't want to have, you know, some kind of pagan trans people, you know, in my nation, you know, my, you know,
well, you don't like Baphomet. But, celebrated at Christmas.
Right.
They did that in Illinois, by the way. No one has explained who decided to do that, of course. It just Baphomet appeared in the state.
Right. I mean, and this isn't live and let live, like, oh, go do your thing. But it's like, you know, it's not going to be about like offing people. It's just going to be like, you're just not doing it here. You're just not doing it here. No, bye, see ya, hit the road, you know? Mm-hmm. And you're certainly not going to be pushing it on our children. You know, I mean, it's just not that, it's not totalitarian. I mean, I'm actually I'm for authority, absolutely, 100%, but not totalitarian.
No, there's a difference between hierarchy and authority and authoritarianism or totalitarianism.
Yeah.
Because there's natural hierarchy and there's legitimate authority.
Correct.
You know, ultimately stems from what we, you know, from the family.
Right.
You know, and that's, there's a sort of, and so at the end of the day, the natural patriarchy is far more liberal and humanitarian than any liberal order, and that's natural authority. And that's why it works.
Absolutely.
And that's why the family has been the prime focus or target for the cultural Marxists and these, because they want to destroy patriarchal authority, which they see. This is part of the authority and personality that the American Jewish Committee published, was literally they thought that a healthy family was the seed of fascism. So they had to disrupt and destroy the healthy family, which usually involved upending patriarchal father, you know, the authority of the father, and promoting sexual degeneracy. And we see what we have today.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I go back to calling it not a culture war, but an existential war. Because if you have a war on the family, and, you know, that means procreation is ceasing.
Well, they're literally a war on fertility because they're devoting so many resources to the chemical castration, sterility of people through transgenderism. Tucker Carlson touched on that on his address at the Heritage Foundation, where he said,
actually, before he got canned, he was doing some really great stuff on, you know, just talking about how the war on Christianity, you know, I mean, you hear that and you're like, oh, whatever. I mean,
he was getting closer and closer.
Oh my gosh. I would just watch it and be like, hey, kids, come in here. And I'd watch it again and be like, listen to what he's saying. I can't believe he's saying this.
And he's Episcopalian. He's just, you know, the shallowest of all faiths. So I guess
that's what he said.
Yes. So I guess he's going to convert soon. That's what maybe. He said when a Treasury Secretary says that abortion is good for the economy, that's not the political debate. It's evil. Same thing with the transgenderism. So this is just evil. It's not a political debate. And he talked about, I used to think that him being being an Anglo-American thought that all you have to do is marshal the best arguments, write a good position paper, you win the debate. It's just that isn't the case, actually. It's and they don't believe, the other side doesn't believe in these rules. We're seeing that. I'm watching Victor Davis Hanson. He's lamenting what's going on. He's calls it, America's going through a revolution, and we need to do this and that in order to restore order. Well, there's been a revolution already. The revolution already occurred, and they don't believe in these rules anymore. And a lot of that is because they've simply flooded the country with people who don't believe in these things.
Right.
Obviously, that's going to happen. Yeah.
And not even the universals, like we were talking earlier, and the abortion thing just proves it. Like, it's bad to murder people. Well, I mean, we haven't agreed on that since 1973,
Yeah. Can you include Aztecs in our politicals? Because essentially that's what these people are, by the way.
Yeah.
They're baby killing, Luciferian, Satan worshiping, freaks, and they're in power. I mean, Joe Biden, Dylan Mulvaney interviewed Joe Biden, that trans, the Bud Light guy. The White House gave him time with the President of the United States.
Yeah.
That's how bizarre it is. And they had a drag queen show at the White House.
It's crazy.
And,
but again, it's
and, the Navy's celebrating a cross-dresser.
Right. But, somebody at West Point can't have a battle flag in their dorm room,
That's
come
evil.
On. That's super evil. Yeah, but it's interesting you break up Victor Davis Hanson because he's no fan of the South.
Nope.
He is a super duper big time Lincolnian. And it's just, you just want to say to him,
I told you
so. Smart people have been saying this for a really long time, sir. And you just didn't want to hear it, And not that I told him so, because I've just been doing this a few years, but Clyde Wilson has been telling them this. Dr. Don Livingston has been telling this, Tom Fleming, very, very smart people have been saying this for a long time, and he just poo-pooed them. So, it's a bitter pill. I get it. But Lincolnianism ain't going to cut it, because you cannot make a functioning people out of an idea. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, it's organic. It's almost like, I saw an article that said there's a pyramid. It's almost like we've been given, remember the food pyramid? It was all wrong.
Right.
Well, we've given a false political pyramid.
Yeah.
We think ideas, and from those ideas, there's a people, actually it's reverse. It's from a people. And that people is sort of a, I don't know, can I use the term blood and soil without scaring people?
Yeah,
it's natural, blood and soil. And then from that, there's a culture, and from that culture develops a people, and the people develop on ideas, but there's a foundation for it. Liberalism, there's no foundation to it.
Yeah.
And that's, and that's where you get that natural order of things. And that's where where the Yankee, the social engineer, the Talmudist who constantly wants to, improve the world on their idea of things, and they're constant revolutionaries. That's where you get. I mean, a Trotskyite is sort of like a radical Yankee in many ways, right? Constant revolution, neoconservatism, these things, constant conflict, and it's just constant warfare, and it's a war on human nature, which ultimately why it failed, because human nature reflects the nature's God,
right?
So, but anyway, well, I said I had you for an hour and a half. I'm cheating a little bit. I'm gonna let you go.
Okay, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it, Timothy. It's been fun, and thank you so much for finding me and having me on.
Well, thank you on the show. So you want to plug your work real fast?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
It's all at dissidentmama.net, and it's over 6 years worth of essays, and I've been podcasting for 3 years. And, you can find everything there. So go, like my podcasts have all the show notes, Odyssey, YouTube, whatever. Sometimes things get kicked off of YouTube and they're on Odyssey and whatnot. I don't put out content every single day because I am a mom. And, you know, I tend to write deep dives too. So a lot of times I'm working on something for a while before it comes out. But, you know, I think what I do is pretty interesting, and I talk to great people on my podcast, just like Timothy does. He has good taste, as do I. And I just like learning. I like learning and trying to figure things out and trying to expose things when I see things that are going awry. So that's what I do, dissidentmama.net. Oh, and I forgot this too. I should not have. I'm also the founder of the Ludwell Orthodox Fellowship, which is about nurturing the roots of Orthodoxy in Dixie's land. And that is southernorthodox.org.
Okay, excellent. I'll provide the links for that. And,
excellent.
And of course, the book was is The Honorable Cause, A Free South, 12 mm-hmm. Southern Essays.
Yep, available on Amazon.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.